You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Liam Hansen tōku ingoa. Nō mai, haere mai, ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāmere Thursday. I'm your host Liam, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whāki nei, coming up on The Wire today, I've had BFM's first chat with Defence Minister Andrew Little for 2023, where we talked about his first couple of weeks in the role and the extreme weather events in Te Ika a Maui, the North Island. Continuing on with the cyclone and weather reporting, I spoke to Tahiti Stone from Niwa about the links between Cyclone Gabriel and the climate crisis. We also have BFM European correspondent Cameron Adams back on for Eurovision, chatting about the war in Ukraine, Scotland First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's resignation, and more. Producer Hannah Thompson spoke to Professor Ewan Mason from the New Zealand School of Forestry at the University of Canterbury about erosion in the cyclones. And lastly, I spoke to Sophie Lunder-Emerson, an Oxford University researcher at the Wildlife Conservation Research Unit in Denmark. We had a chat about her discovery of the world's oldest hedgehog, named Thorvald, and what it means for the species conservation. Here, aha or whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces today, so please get in touch. Tuku pā tuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or wire mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, ka awe e wareware I ahe ana koto te whakarongo ki ene koreru ano he pakeori roki roki maurangi I te pai tukutuku u urerangai pōhoa. Me haere ki 95BFM, I re kati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
With new Prime Minister Chris Hipkins' cabinet reshuffle, Andrew Little switched over from the health portfolio to the defence portfolio, retaining all other titles. This was shortly before the floods hit Auckland and cyclones hit Te Ika a Maui, the North Island. This has seen the New Zealand Defence Force deployed to assist thousands of people across the country, seeing many stranded on rooftops and in other dangerous areas in need of safety. We had a chat about all that and more in our first weekly catch-up of 2023. I first asked him how he's found the first couple of weeks of the Defence Minister role.
Been pretty full on, obviously. Been in the role for just over 2 weeks, and of course it's the time that we've been struck with, first of all, the floods in Auckland and then the cyclone this week, and which has required a massive response from New Zealand Defence Force personnel. They've really turned out. We have now nearly 700 people in the New Zealand Defence Forces allocated from Northland to Auckland, Tairāwhiti, Bay of Plenty and Hawke's Bay, and then all the equipment that goes with that. So it's been a big effort from them. As well as that, I've been obviously getting up to speed with some of the longer-term issues with our defence forces, and so just working up a plan to deal with some of those long-term issues as we get through the immediate ones as well.
Did you feel well-suited and prepared for the role?
Oh, I'm not unfamiliar with defence issues and with my responsibilities in relation to the intelligence agencies. There's a bit of crossover between intelligence and defence, so I've been familiar with some of their issues, and I've worked with previous defence ministers, Penny Henare, Ron Mark before him. So yeah, and look, it's I think we have some pretty incredible people in our services. I've been out with them in my first term in Parliament. I had a week with the Navy, including a couple of nights out at sea with them. I see the quality of their training, the quality of their skills. I think we're well served by them, and it's an honour to be the minister responsible for them.
And as you mentioned, the Defence Force has, of course, played a big part in the response to the flooding in Auckland and Cyclone Gabriel. Do you think that the New Zealand Defence Force was well equipped to deal with this crisis?
Yeah, they've certainly pressed everything they've got into service. We've got multiple helicopters, the big NH90s that have quite a bit of capacity and lift capacity. We now have, I think, six of them in service. We've got a Sea Sprite helicopter, one of the naval ones that's been helping with reconnaissance. We've got ships. I mean, they sent out the one of the frigates, one of our biggest naval vessels, to help with a rescue of a yachty, a lone yachty, in the Hauraki Gulf a couple of nights ago. They've packed up the Manawanui to go down to Gisborne, to Napier with provisions. So they are throwing everything at it that they've got. We're a comparatively small defence force across our three services. They do have to keep a certain amount of capability and capacity on standby, not just for emergencies like this, but in case things happen in the islands or we're needed overseas. So as well as responding in huge numbers to the floods and the cyclone, there are still reserve capacity just in case something else happens, and that's the way they have to manage it.
Were there any big differences from your end in the floods, in the response to the floods versus the cyclones, other than just size and scale?
No, pretty much. I mean, we're dependent on, in the Auckland floods, it was dependent on Auckland emergency management to deploy what they needed from New Zealand Defence Forces. They got assistance, we got personnel involved up there, but what they did was at the direction of the Auckland Emergency Management. With Cyclone Gabrielle, because it became a national state of emergency, instructions to New Zealand Defence Force came from the National Emergency Management Centre based in Wellington. And there are very strong links between that agency, National Emergency Management Agency, and Defence Forces. So I think it's just been of a bigger scale, obviously more effort has gone into the cyclone response than the floods.
The Defence Force did largely come in because it was a national state of emergency, and there were some people criticising if the Defence Force should have been quicker into the fray with the floods. Do you think that maybe there should be some change to the rules to allow state of emergencies to be easier deployed in regional areas?
The Defence Force, they are, it is a military function, and there are very, very clear rules, as there need to be when we're using our military forces for civilian purposes. And so the law set up and the legal framework set up around that is very clear that that instruction has to come from the civilian authorities. That's either the local emergency management arrangement, which in Auckland was the Auckland Emergency Management Centre, or it's the National Emergency Management Agency. So the instruction has to come from there. Otherwise, they can't have the military deploying for civilian purposes on their own initiative. That would be a recipe for all sorts of trouble in different circumstances.
Of course, as you just mentioned, it shouldn't necessarily be the New Zealand Defence Force deciding to step in where possible, but there has been a lot of people who've been pointing out how these sorts of storm and extreme weather responses are becoming a far more frequent and far more volatile, deadly experience for Aotearoa. Do you think that storm and extreme weather event responses could become a bigger focus for the training and funding of the New Zealand Defence Force in the future?
Yeah, well, it is. It's already a core competency for them because they are. Humanitarian assistance and disaster relief is a critical function for our New Zealand Defence Forces, not just for New Zealand, but particularly for the Pacific Islands. Every year, they are deployed somewhere in the Pacific to assist with disaster recovery. So they do that. And yeah, you're right. We know with climate change, these weather events will become more intense and more frequent. So that will be a core part of what they do. But again, they are a military. Ultimately, they are trained in combat. There is a hard edge to what they do, that hard edge that equips them well to go into situations of reasonably high degree of hazard or danger and able to do what they do. But there's no question disaster relief and recovery is going to be a big part of what they do for some time to come.
And just one last question, more towards your portfolio as the Minister for Treaty Negotiations. Although Waitangi Day does now, within the past week, feel like it was a long, long time ago, it was just around a week ago. It took place very recently. Were there any major takeaways or changes that you found at the Waitangi Tribunal this year?
Yeah, I was quite busy actually this year. I was up there for about 5 or 6 days and had quite a busy kind of program of things to do. The one event that stood out, I'm not sure kind of what coverage it got, but there was an event where a local farming family had been working with two of the local hapū, and because of what the hapū leaders had told them, they found there was an old pā site on their farm that was of quite significant, of great significance to the two hapū, and the farming family had made an arrangement to hand back that pā site to the two hapū. The government got involved because we assisted with building a road, an access road from the main road to the pā site. It had to go across farmland and negotiated with other farmers and what have you, and also assisted with the technical and legal work of effectively subdividing the piece of land that the pā site was on. It was an incredible thing for that farming family to do. We had a bit of a ceremony and they spoke about what they realised and the epiphany that they'd had and the importance for them to hand that piece of land back. And then talking to one of the hapū rangatira afterwards, he talked about how the difference that gesture had made to a lot of the hapū there, that it opened their minds about, gee, what, you know, we start getting land back that's of significance to us, we've got some, you know, we've got some opportunity here, it gives us a bit of hope about the future, it restores our sense of this is our place. That was an incredibly powerful little event that we went in, and I think hugely symbolic, and hopefully we'll see more of it.
That was Minister for Treaty Negotiations as well as Defence, Andrew Little, chatting about the floods in Auckland, his time in the Defence role thus far, and the recent Waitangi Tribunal.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
We are going to go to a quick break and then be back with more reporting on the cyclones after this.
Calling all units, it's MOTAT's hottest live day of the year, Fire and Emergency. Discover the heroic history of New Zealand firefighters with MOTAT's emergency collection of firefighting equipment. See the New Zealand police dogs in action. Get educated on what to do in an emergency with Fire and Emergency NZ and the NZ Defence Force, and see real-life emergencies at road crash rescue demonstrations. Fire and Emergency Live Day at MOTAT, Sunday, February 19th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more info, go to motat.nz.
95BFM presents Henry Rollins.
So I went into a series of minimum wage jobs thinking, well, that's going to be my life. I'm going to live in a Bruce Springsteen lyric.
Back in New Zealand for the first time since 2016, the Black Flag frontman and acclaimed spoken word artist recounts the events of his life leading up to COVID and the strange, strange things that have happened since.
It's a three-finger point. If you want a point like Dio.
Henry Rollins, good to see you. 2023 tour. Thursday, July 6th at Sky City Theatre. Tickets on sale now from plusone.co.nz.
A battle rages inside of you. In the red corner, Barefoot Bandit. In the blue corner, Sneaker Supreme. Well, there's an obvious solution to this one. Check this out. Toe shoes. Toe. Shoes. The future is flexible, my friend.
Shaky Isles Coffee. Brewed different for footwear fantasists. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind.
Arcade Radio.
Show me that you're mine, though. Alright.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
The vast and harsh impacts of Aotearoa dealing with its worst flood and worst cyclone in history within just 2 weeks of each other has led to stronger calls than ever for strong and long-lasting climate policy. Climate Minister James Shaw has been a particularly vocal candidate, claiming that the government has spent too much time bickering about whether or not the crisis is real or not, which has led to the issues that we are currently struggling with. To learn more about the links between the climate crisis and the extreme weather events, I spoke to Dighty Stone, a climate scientist from NIWA. He first ran over how much cause and effect there was between global warming and the crazy weather.
I think one thing to realize is that this is partly a freak. We've got a La Nina happening, which happens occasionally. That's very hot water in the eastern tropical Pacific around Indonesia. Sorry, that's western tropical Pacific around Indonesia. And when that happens, there's lots of thunderstorms which push air out and affect the winds all around the world, really, but particularly around here in New Zealand. It tends to push a tropical air our way. So this was actually kind of seen in the seasonal forecast that it would be a wet summer for the north, but the extent of it, of course, hadn't been expected. So that said, I mean, there are aspects of it when you get this sort of circulation where our warming world probably has had an influence. One of them is that the water is warmer, so it's more keen to evaporate its the air. The water into the air, and the air itself is warmer as well and able to hold more water. So it comes along, and when it hits the mountains of New Zealand and releases it, there's much more water to come out now.
While these are freak events, as you said, could we still expect more of these to be taking place?
The question of whether we can expect more or not is one we're really not quite sure about right now. What we can expect is that when they occur, they'll be more intense. So that's, I think, what we're seeing right now. This, I think we can pretty confidently say that this event is more intense than it would have been. The rainfall that we've been getting is more intense than it if we hadn't been interfering with the climate. But whether the event would have been more like this wet summer would have been more or less likely is a harder one to say.
There has also been recent, more separate reports reconfirming the ice caps around the world are melting, continuing at a worrying rate. Does this link to the severity and frequency of the recent weather events?
Well, it's part of the whole story of climate change driven by humans. We're warming the planet, and one of those effects is that the ice is going to melt, and there will be less of it in the winter when it's there around the sea. So it is part of the whole story of what we're doing to the climate. As my colleague Sam Dean likes to say, we're doing an uncontrolled experiment with this planet right now. Some of it we can kind of understand and predict what's going to happen, but there will be some surprises in store as well.
Is there anything that we can do at this rate to try and stop the climate change from causing such vast destruction, or at least do anything to minimize the scale?
Well, reducing emissions, that's something that the entire world has to do collectively. So that we don't go down a path where these things get even more severe and more intense. We've got, but the climate change, the climate system is a bit of a flywheel. So we do have some climate change locked in already, no matter what we do. But closer to home, start preparing for disasters. I think one thing that we've seen over the past few years, actually, is, I mean, New Zealand's prone to a lot of climate, of weather, extreme types of weather. So being ready for that in our vulnerable communities, just being prepared for these sorts of things, building up resilience just even in a world without climate change, as we meet more events like this.
What steps are scientists, including those at NIWA, currently taking to understand these events better?
We've got a number of projects going on. For instance, there's one funded by MBIE called the Whakahura Project, which is particularly looking at how extreme weather has been affected by climate change in New Zealand, and how it will change over the coming couple of decades. I think one of the things to realize is that we are in a different climate now than we actually think we are in, because most of what we think of our climate is actually from, say, the past 30, 40 years, which is from a time that was different. We had fewer greenhouse gases in the air. We're in a different time now. We're transitioning continually into a warmer world. So to realize how these sorts of extremes are changing around the country, a lot of it involves simulating weather and climate on computers. A lot of it involves talking with communities and companies and agencies around the country, understanding what are the aspects that are most that they're most vulnerable to, that they're most exposed to, they should be most concerned about.
And is it likely that we should try and expect either colder and more harsh weather for the upcoming winter months, or could we perhaps see a switch where those months tend to be maybe a bit warmer than usual?
These days, it's pretty safe to say we're going to get a season that's warmer than usual. It's a good bet. I could get a colder one. I haven't seen the seasonal forecast right now, but it's, as I said, usual is for a climate that, you know, covers the past 30 years, which was cooler than we're in now. So the warmer than usual is actually kind of the norm. Just I hope for everyone in the affected areas that they're coming out of it intact, and the best of luck.
That was NIWA climate scientist Daiti Stone chatting about the links between the climate crisis and the recent extreme weather events across Tāmaki Makaurau and Te Ika Ā-Māui. We're going to have another quick ad break and then be back after this with Eurovision.
Back on stage for the first time since 2010. It's only Bloody Pavement.
You're wanting a blue moon's chance to catch the gold sounds of one of the American underground's defining bands. And with tickets from just $99.
95BFM presents Pavement. One show only. With special guests Half Hexagon. March 7 at the gorgeous Civic Theatre. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
What's a 7-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
a live tribute to the internet, followed by DJs Carlotta and Kirsty Sutherland.
And tomorrow,
DJs V and Soultree.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jabden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your bass lines lying around here.
Unexpectedly heartfelt ukulele performance there from Iceland.
It's Eurovision on 95 BFM with our European correspondent, Cameron Adams.
Much of Scotland, the United Kingdom and Europe as a whole was shocked when Scotland First Minister Nicola Sturgeon announced her resignation recently. Sturgeon has been incredibly vocal on the Scottish independence movement, having seen the country through a failed referendum in 2014 and renewed efforts recently in the coming out of the Brexit agreement. This and more has been taking place over the last week in Europe, as reported by BFM European correspondent Cameron Adams. First up, he gave us an update on the war in Ukraine.
Fighting is continuing in Bakhmut, with Ukrainian forces conceding that they are losing territory to Russian forces slowly. NATO has today announced more support for Ukraine, pledging 48 more Leopard 2 tanks and stating to boost ammunition output. It's reported that Ukraine is firing up to 10,000 artillery shells a day, which is draining Western inventories.
Scottish politics was rocked today by the shock announcement of First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's resignation. What happened?
Yeah, it was a shock this morning as Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon resigned, saying that, quote, in my head and in my heart, it was the right time to step down. She spoke of the brutality of modern politics and its personal toll on her, and that in the interest of the SNP and Scotland, she will step down. She's been a senior leader within the SNP for almost 20 years. She was the Deputy First Minister from 2007 and, after the failed 2014 referendum on Scottish independence, became the leader and First Minister. She's been a strong campaigner for Scottish independence and, following Brexit, has been pushing for a second vote and being seen as kind of one of the faces or the face of Scottish independence.
So what does this mean for Scottish politics?
Yeah, well, it comes at a critical time in the independence campaign. In January, a transgender rights law that was passed in the Scottish Parliament was blocked by UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak under the Scotland Act. And in November, the Supreme Court also ruled against a unilateral referendum on Scottish independence. Both of those actions were used by Sturgeon to campaign on the need for Scottish independence, claiming that the rulings were an attack on Scottish democracy. So next month, the SNP have a conference, or they're supposed to have a conference, on how to approach a second referendum. And I'd say that it will still be campaigned for, but maybe the aggressive timeline pursued by Sturgeon might be lengthened.
Who could be the next leader of the SNP?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's not really a clear successor. There are three top contenders. So John Swinney, the current Deputy First Minister. However, he had a difficult time as SNP leader in the 2000s. There also could be the current Finance Secretary, Kate Forbes, who's currently on maternity leave. However, she's an active member of an evangelical Scottish church and has previously spoken out against abortion. And then there's the former Westminster leader of the SNP, Angus Robertson. But I mean, it's anyone's guess, really. It's up to the party members to nominate and then vote on a new leader, and it could take weeks or months.
So over in France, strikes and demonstrations are continuing over plans to raise the retirement age. What are people's concerns?
Yeah, strikes have been growing since the announcement of French Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne last month to raise the retirement age in France from 62 to 64 by 2030, with up to 1 million people protesting across the country on Saturday against the plans. It's been a campaign promise of President Emmanuel Macron since 2017, and after another election win last year, he's determined to push through the change. And while you might think the win was a mandate for this change, many voters reluctantly voted for him to prevent the far-right Marie Le Pen from getting the presidency. The changes would also remove special retirement options for some public workers. It's estimated that extending the age would provide an additional 17 billion euros in pension payments. So there are concerns that it would overly hurt the poor and those working in manual labour, and that instead wealthy households and big companies should be taxed more to offset the rising pension costs. One of Macron's own ministers was quoted as saying that it would, quote, leave women a little penalised.
Is it likely to actually stop the increase?
Probably not. I mean, although they may get some concessions similar to what the Yellow Jackets protest got with regard to the fuel tax. In theory, Macron's party could ram through the legislation, even though they have a minority in Parliament. However, they're still looking for the support of other right-wing parties. It's currently under examination by French parliamentary committees, which could propose some minor changes, and the law is expected to pass by September. In response, there's another transport strike tomorrow, and unions have been calling for a wider strike on March 7th. The last time pensions were raised was in 2010 under Nicolas Sarkozy. That was from 60 to 62 and also caused widespread protests and strikes.
And in Portugal, a report detailing sexual abuse in the Catholic Church was recently released. What was in the report?
At least 4,800 children were sexually abused by members of the Portuguese Catholic Church over the past 70 years. That's according to a newly released report commissioned by the Catholic Church and spoke to more than 500 victims. This comes after allegations last year of the Portuguese Catholic Church involved in cover-ups of sexual abuse, including bishops who remain active in the church. Over three quarters of the perpetrators were priests, and more than half of the victims were men, with abuse happening in churches, schools, and other locations. The majority of victims were aged between 10 to 14, with the youngest being 2. It's stated that this is the absolute minimum number of victims. Only 25 cases have been passed to public prosecutors after most crimes have fallen past the statute of limitations. The report has called for decisive action by the judiciary, psychological care for the victims, and a suspension of the statute of limitations. There's a meeting on March 3rd by Portuguese bishops to discuss the report.
And in slightly lighter news, a man in Spain has won the right to walk down the street naked in his home village. Could you tell us more?
Yeah, nudist Alejandro Colomar has won the right to walk down the street naked in his home, in his village of Aldea on the outskirts of Valencia. The 29-year-old had faced constant fines by police who accused him of obscene exhibitionism. However, thanks to his own research, he noted that as long as there was no sexual intent, he was well within his rights, with Spain legalizing public nudity since 1988. The Spanish court agreed and struck down an earlier ruling against him, acknowledged that he was within his rights to be naked, noting that he had limited himself to only a couple of streets in his village and didn't affect public order. To attend the ruling, Colomar had turned up to the court wearing just hiking boots, however was forced to put on clothes by court security officers.
That was BFM European correspondent Cameron Adams chatting about the war in Ukraine, Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's resignation, industrial action taking place in France, and much more taking place across Europe.
Macedonia with a reggae twist.
That was Eurovision on 95 BFM.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Sticking around in Europe, researchers over at Oxford University's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit, based in Denmark, have recently discovered the world's oldest hedgehog. The hedgehog, who was named Thorvald, was 16 years old, 7 years older than the previous known record, and incredibly old compared to the average hedgehog age of two. I spoke to lead researcher Sophie Lund-Ramison about her research and what it means for hedgehog conservation.
So the Danish Hedgehog Project is a research project on European hedgehogs, and it's based on citizen science. So back in 2016, I asked the Danish citizens to collect dead hedgehogs for my research so that I could use the dead to understand the living, because we see a drastic decline in the populations of European hedgehogs all over Europe. And we want to discover what is causing this decline so we can stop it and save the hedgehogs in the wild. So the Danish citizens collected dead hedgehogs from all over Denmark back in 2016. Over 400 volunteers participated, and they collected a staggering 697 dead hedgehogs for my research.
How did you discover the 16-year-old hedgehog, Thorvald?
Yes, so what happened was that we necropsied all these dead hedgehogs. And the ones who had intact jaw bones, we used for age determination studies. So basically, what we can do is to cut micro-thin slices of their jaw bones and then dye them to make these earrings appear. And these earrings, they grow because the hedgehogs hibernate. And during hibernation, they stop growing. So the calcium in their bones there is sort of formed into rings while they're not growing. So they have these earrings. So basically, I could count the earrings of the hedgehog jawbones to see how old each individual became before it died. And I did that 388 times because we had jawbones from 388 individuals. And then suddenly one day, when I was looking in the microscope, I could tell that this was a very old hedgehog because I could see a lot of lines. And I started counting, and suddenly I reached 16. And I was just amazed and really happy about this discovery.
What does this mean for hedgehog conservation?
So this basically means that if a hedgehog can actually live to be 16 years old, this particular individual would have contributed to the reproduction of the species for at least 15 mating seasons. So this individual would have produced a lot of offspring in his lifetime. And this is really important when you have a population that is in decline, because of course we need a lot of hoglets to be born for the population to survive. Unfortunately, you could say that the mean age of these 388 hedgehogs, it was just below 2 years. So it's only a few individuals that actually lived to become very old. And the two-year-olds, they can only participate in 1 to 2 mating seasons before they died. So this is a completely different picture. But I mean, this shows us that there's still hope for the population, because some individuals actually become very old.
Do we now know what the best conditions are for hedgehogs to survive in, or is this the next step that we need to learn more about?
at least we know that the hedgehogs are increasingly seeking habitats around human occupation. So they live in our gardens, in our residential gardens these days. They prefer the urban life to the rural life, because farming has become so intensified, so it's hard being a hedgehog in the rural areas. So they seek areas of human occupation. So the best habitats for them are, of course, gardens that are hedgehog friendly. So this is a reminder to people to actually make sure that your garden is hedgehog friendly, that the hedgehogs have places to stay, to build nests, that the gardens attract a lot of biodiversity so that the hedgehogs can forage and find natural food items such as slugs or insects for that matter. And then we have to be aware that some of our activities in the gardens are posing threats to hedgehogs. So this particular individual, Thorvald, who became 16 years old, he died because he was attacked by a dog that bit him. And these injuries were just infected, and he didn't receive the treatment in time to actually save him. So this is a problem. But hedgehogs are also killed every year due to garden tools, for example. Some hedgehogs drown in our swimming pools and ponds because even though they're excellent swimmers, if they can't get up again, they'll eventually drown just from pure exhaustion. And hedgehogs are also poisoned by all the different poisons we use in our gardens, you know, against slugs, for example, or against insects, or rodenticides against mice and rats. So we really have to consider that the hedgehogs are sharing habitats with us and make sure that they're safe when they're in our gardens.
Why is it important to preserve hedgehog wildlife?
Every species serves a role in the food chain. And of course, hedgehogs do that as well. And they eat insects, they scavenge, so they basically clean up in the wild. But I mean, can we spare them? Yes, we probably can. A lot of wildlife has gone extinct during the past 1,000 years, and nature is still around. But I think it's important to preserve the hedgehogs because they're just really special. First of all, everybody knows what a hedgehog looks like, and everybody loves hedgehogs. And then the hedgehog is one of the few species we can actually get very close to in the wild. So this species provides us with a very unique nature experience because we can come close to them, we can study them, we can watch them. They don't run away necessarily because they tend to completely freeze or curl up when facing danger, and compared to a bird that will fly away or a fox that runs very fast, we can actually get very close to them. And I think that's important as well. So it's more a matter of, you know, values. Do we want the hedgehogs to stay or not?
So what are the next steps for the Danish Hedgehog Project for you?
So basically, we are doing toxicological screenings right now. So all these dead hedgehogs, the ones that still had livers when they were collected for the research, they've been used for this toxicological screening. So we're basically figuring out which different compounds, chemical compounds that accumulate in the hedgehogs to see whether the hedgehogs are poisoned. So I'm really excited about this, and I hope that the results will be published within this year.
And my last, just quick question, did the name Thorvald come from yourself?
No, so this was actually the hedgehog carer who received Thorvald, and she decided to name him Thorvald because she likes the classical Danish names. So she just thought he was a Thorvald, or Thorvald in Danish.
That was Sophie Lund Remmersen, a researcher at Oxford University's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit based in Denmark, about her discovery of the world's oldest hedgehog.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We've got a quick tune before our last piece for today. This is Expectations by Cut Off Your Hands.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
One of the most devastating impacts of Cyclone Gabrielle has been the slips that we've seen throughout the North Island. This disaster has prompted inquiry into how we structure our landscapes and cities, including how this impacts on erosion rates. I spoke to Professor Ewan Mason from the New Zealand School of Forestry at the University of Canterbury, and I started by asking him to contextualise Aotearoa's forestry.
New Zealand was originally mostly forest, probably somewhere between 80 and 90% forest before people arrived. And the reason for that is it's a temperate country. It has reasonably good rainfall, and so the temperatures are conducive to forest. So it's naturally forest land. When people arrived, they tended to be forest. So, for instance, we estimate about a third of our forest was deforested before the Europeans arrived, and about another third was deforested after they arrived, in order to create areas for hunting, in order to create farms in the case of the colonial period. So what we've been left with is about 6.5 million hectares of native forest. Much of that is in hill country. Most of the lowlands have been deforested, and there are whole forest types that have been converted into farms. So we're left with about 6.5 million hectares, mainly in the sloping land of native forest. And around the turn of the century, the 20th century, there was a lot of discussion about the fact that while forests had been a critical part of New Zealand's economy up until that time, and well, in fact, forest produce, either in the form of wood or in the form of kauri-gum, had been our main export in the 19th century, people could see that the forest was being destroyed at a rather rapid rate. And they were becoming concerned about whether New Zealand could actually support its own wood supply needs, rather than just have, despite the fact that we've been exporting wood. So that brought about the creation of, finally, I think it was about 1919, the Forest Service was created. And it was charged with providing New Zealand with a domestic wood supply in perpetuity by 1960. And it set about examining the species that were available and the amount of forest we already had and how fast these species were growing and the technology that was needed in order to harvest them and actually regenerate them and so on. And rapidly came to the conclusion that exotic species were a better prospect for giving us a domestic wood supply. And so they set about establishing exotic species in plantations. So we now have, I guess as part of that, they created our forest industry sector. It wasn't long before private enterprise realized that the Forest Service had demonstrated very clearly that there was money to be made by growing exotic species in plantations. So now we have about, estimates vary between about 1.7 and 2 million hectares of plantation forest. And about 90% of the area in plantation forest is radiata pine.
By the sounds of it, most of our forestry is made up of monoculture pine. What sort of...
Most of our production forest is monoculture, yes.
What impact does this have on forest systems?
We've had those arguments in academia and also in the Forest Service for many, many decades. About is it wise to predominantly grow only one species? And it's been recognized that it's a risk. Now, so far, the risk has paid off. Radiata pine is by far the most financially productive species that we have. And in most sites, it grows very, very well. There are sites where it won't. And people have tended to grow other species like Douglas fir, for instance, in the colder regions of New Zealand. It's always a question when you have an industry that's primarily private enterprise, if we're going to grow other species to diversify, then who's going to take the financial hit?
the Ministry of Forestry is preparing an inquiry into forestry and land use in the East Coast. Is there anything else that warrants this inquiry?
The East Coast is characterized by very unstable soils. So when the forest was removed and it was put into grass, that created a problem. And we had massive amounts of erosion. The erosion would occur in the hills. The silt would come down into the flatlands that were already in farm, and those farms would be devastated by the silt. And so for that reason, there have been organized attempts, particularly in one or two catchments at first, where people established forests in order to try and reduce erosion. And there's very clear evidence from studies that have been done after previous cyclones that if you compare grassland with forestland, grassland attracts a much, much higher level of erosion.
What are the impacts of erosion?
Well, the topsoil disappears from the land and it flows down through the rivers and into flatlands and can be quite devastating on farms, say dairy farms on flatland, for instance, can be overwhelmed with the silt and debris from the erosion events.
Is erosion what causes these crazy slips that we've been seeing over the last few days?
Yeah, they are erosion. But in addition, there's the issue of slash, which is if you've done harvesting and you've left behind material on the land, then quite clearly some of that material, if it's on highly erodible land and it's sloping land, then the slash can move. And move on to other people's properties, move down rivers, break bridges, do all the sorts of damage that we've seen, end up on beaches in some cases.
Besides the cyclone, there's also been just a massive uptick in rainfall this summer across the North Island. Has this placed additional pressure on our forest systems or accentuated erosion?
Yes, it has. And the big erosion events tend to be, with the things like the events we remember are events like Cyclone Bola. Where, of course, for the people living in the area where the erosion is taking place, they have all sorts of negative effects.
And is there a greater risk as climate change accelerates extreme weather events like Cyclone Gabrielle?
If climate change causes more cyclones to hit New Zealand, then that will be an increase in risk. Now, clearly, establishing forest on what has been grassland is one way of more rapidly solving the short-term problem. It's a short-term measure because forests only accumulate carbon while they develop. So that means that forests can only be a temporary solution. They can fill gaps in our carbon accounts to help us get to, for instance, greenhouse gas neutrality by 2050, but they're not a long-term solution. The long-term solution is for us to reduce emissions, and we can't get around that. There's no known solution other than reducing emissions.
That was Professor Ewan Mason speaking on trees, erosion, and climate change mitigation.
That was The Wire.
Ko edite ho takakatoa mo tene wiki. Nei te mihi kia koto katoa I korero mai ki au mo tene ra. That is a wrap on the Thursday Wire. Thank you to everyone that spoke with us today. Defence Minister Andrew Little, Tahiti Stone from Niwa, BFM European correspondent Cameron Adams, Professor Ewan Mason from the New Zealand School of Forestry at the University of Canterbury, and Sophie Lynn Remsen, an Oxford University researcher at the Wildlife Conservation Research Unit in Denmark. Thank you to Hannah Thompson for contributing pieces to today's show. And Neira Hokete Mehi Kia Koto I Whakarango Ana, thank you for tuning in. The Wonderful is up next. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.